At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From the 1930s all the way through the 1960s, business was, shall we say, smoking for the world's leading tobacco company. Boy, how times have changed. There's just not as much call for Philip Morris products, at least not here at home these days. So the parent company, Altria, figures it'll be more profitable to focus on the growth market overseas. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Bantam Books, publisher of Super Crunchers, Why Thinking by Numbers is the New Way to Be Smart, by Ian Ayers. More at supercrunchers.com. And by Bank of America, through community outreach, philanthropic giving, and environmental efforts, finding opportunity and embracing it. Bank of America, Bank of Opportunity, bankofamerica.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon, in for Kai Ryssdal. Glad you can join us on this Wednesday, the 29th day of August. You may remember a few months back that the Altria Group spun off Kraft Foods. Today, the company announced another big spinoff, Philip Morris, the world's largest private tobacco company. Basically, Philip Morris will be split in two, the U.S. arm, loaded with huge regulatory hurdles, and the international business, which is expanding rapidly in the developing world. From the America's Desk at WLRN, Marketplace's Dan Gretsch has more.
The Marlboro Man is Philip Morris's signature icon. He's an all-American cowboy, handsome and rugged. Altria's announcement doesn't mean that the Marlboro Man's riding off into the sunset. His new homestead will be in Switzerland, headquarters for an independent international operation.
Philip Morris is absolutely looking for greener pastures.
Damon Moglen heads the international program at the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. He says anti-smoking campaigns and lawsuits have hurt Philip Morris in the U.S.
It's becoming harder and harder to do the dirty business here in the United States, and there is a recognition that in developing countries in Asia and Latin America and Africa, which is really where future smokers are to be identified.
The international market's blowing smoke rings around the U.S. Last year, Philip Morris International sold 830 billion cigarettes, four times as many as its U.S. counterpart. And the company's snatching up foreign tobacco firms in places like Mexico, the Dominican Republic, and Pakistan. Vanessa O'Connell covers the tobacco industry for the Wall Street Journal. She says the spinoff will allow the international business to expand even faster.
Philip Morris International could use its own stock as currency in acquisitions so that it might become a more aggressive acquirer going forward, and that could be one of the vehicles that helps it continue to grow.
The Altria Group declined to comment on air. Several class action lawsuits against Philip Morris are still pending, but analysts don't think they'll derail the spinoff. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Do you get the feeling investors can't seem to make up their minds? One day the Dow plunges 280 points, and the next day, that would be today, the Dow rockets back 247 points. We lurch from exuberance to gloom and back. So which is the rational side? I'll check back in about 5 years or so for that answer, but we do know that once emotions loosen the markets, where it all ends can be anybody's guess. And as Marketplace's Steve Tripoli tells us, that has a lot of us in some kind of limbo these days.
Even well-heeled potential buyers are thinking twice these days. Lois Vitt has written a book about real estate that focuses on buyer and seller psychology. She says cautions what happens when markets turn sharply south.
Fear is contagious, and that's what's going on right now. People are afraid. And so they worry that they might get in trouble if they go ahead with their plans, and so people are holding back.
Nationwide chatter about a housing bubble and further price drops isn't helping, even if it's accurate, says Wellesley College housing expert Carl Case.
I got a T-shirt that says, Mr. Housing Bubble, I pop and you're done. There's just a lot of press, a lot of news about the mortgage market, about auctions of houses, about foreclosures. If you're in the market about to make a big decision about buying a large asset, that's going to scare you.
It's not only that a house is a big asset, says Case, but it's one most buyers will hold for a long time.
And they borrowed the money to do it. So they naturally have expectations about whether it's likely to go up or down, and it's clear that demand is sensitive to those expectations.
The problem with this negative market psychology is that it can be self-fulfilling. Buyers hold back, prices drop, so more mortgages exceed the home's value and prices drop more. Then buyers pull back even more. I asked Carl Case and Lois Vitt, are we in danger of that kind of negative feedback cycle right now?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
And all the sophisticated computer models and hedge fund managers in the world can't predict where that kind of negative thinking will take us. So fasten your seatbelts. I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace.
If you put yourself in a financial holding pattern for the moment, you've got plenty of company. This kind of guessing and maneuvering is going on even amongst the country's biggest banks and savviest financial minds. What they're doing, or not doing in this case, could ultimately affect all of us, from the rates we pay on credit cards to the monthly adjustable mortgage. And there are fresh signs today the credit crunch isn't letting up. To help us understand what's going on, we turn to John Mason. He's a former economist for the Federal Reserve and the mortgage industry and currently a professor of economics at Penn State. Mr. Mason, appreciate you joining us.
Hi, Bob.
So the central banks that control the money supply around the world have been pumping more and more money into the system in the past several weeks. But we're hearing today that the supply of money actually tightened sharply again. So it sounds to me as if people are still hoarding this money and sitting on it. Why are we still seeing this stubborn reluctance to lend?
Because there's a lot of uncertainty out there, Bob. The market hates uncertainty, and when they don't know where prices should be, they pull back and that they wait until they have a better idea as to where prices should be located.
So they seem to be waiting for what Ben Bernanke is going to have to say at this big central bankers meeting in Wyoming on Friday. It seems to me the experts are saying that the markets have already priced in this formal interest rate cut, and to some degree, they've now sort of danced out there on one of those cliffs dangling off the Grand Tetons, and they're looking down on Jackson Hole, hoping that Mr. Bernanke is really going to throw him a lifeline.
Well, he's got to be very careful here, though. I mean, he just can't let the reins loose and, in a sense, lose control of the market.
Well, what happens if the markets don't get their rate cut now? We're already seeing signs there's still a lot of volatility just under the surface.
Well, the market's been disappointed before.
Set up for a big fall, perhaps?
Well, you saw all the press come out this morning that says, things look pretty bad. And yet, from everything I can see today, it's rebounded and things seem to be just fine.
Well, let's talk about these nagging doubts. If the markets are still so anxious about more financial institutions suffering big losses from the subprime fallout, is there really much the Fed and the other central banks can do about this problem ultimately? You can't go back and erase those bad loans after all.
Well, there's a short run and there's a long run effect. And I don't seem to see what I would call panic. If you go back to some of the other liquidity problems and so forth in 1998 and beyond, earlier than that, that you saw that there was really overnight effects in which there was some real desperate concern in terms of liquidity in the market. Here you get the shutting down of a fund. Here you get the firing of a president and CEO. Here you get some other pullback and things like that. but it doesn't seem like at this particular time there's a rush for the door.
So on the one hand, officials are assuring us that this is limited in scope, that this can be contained. On the other hand, the banks and the lenders don't seem to be buying into that. Why can't the central banks seem to pour enough liquidity on this financial fire?
Well, there's always the danger of going the other way. And we've seen problems in terms of them liquefying too much in the past, which has resulted in a longer-term impact on inflation. And so it's just a very, very narrow tightrope that has to be walked here to take care of the current situation, but not to overreact and have to either really pull back at some time in the future or face concerns over inflation again.
Is this a stare-down match here? Is this just the banks holding out for a bailout?
I don't think so. I think the banks are doing the best they can, and they've got an uncertain situation too. I've been a bank president. When you've got uncertainty in the market and uncertainty in terms of credit quality, that you do pull back for a while until you start seeing that things have stabilized.
John Mason is an economics professor at Penn State. Thank you for your insight, sir.
Sure enough, Bob. Thanks for calling.
Stability is not exactly the word that comes to mind in describing the stock market today. As mentioned, the seesaw swung way back into positive territory, but it's all relative, right? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Would you like to make those annoying, unsightly wrinkles disappear? Well, if you're looking for a dermatologist to give you a Botox shot, the chances are you can arrange that pretty fast. Within a week, a new study has found. But if you're worried about a mole that seems to be changing, you'll probably wait about a month for that same doctor. That's the conclusion of a new study published in the American Academy of Dermatology's journal. From the Marketplace Health Desk at WGBH, Helen Palmer explains why.
This would seem to be a case of follow the money. Diane Baker, president of the American Academy of Dermatology, says cosmetic procedures are lucrative.
Anywhere from $400 to $1,000 for Botox. And for a medical problem, could be as low as $50 or less for a visit.
But analysts say this study, which showed an 8-day wait for Botox versus 26 days for evaluating a mole, highlights the direction American medicine is taking. Paul Ginsberg of the Center for the Study of Health System Change.
This is clearly a case where dermatologists are responding to economic incentives.
Ginsberg says patients pay upfront for cosmetic treatments. Normally, doctors have to file reams of forms and wait weeks for insurance payments. Some observers see a positive lesson here. Glenn Melnick teaches healthcare finance at the University of Southern California.
The market does work. It works in general, and it works in healthcare as well.
Melnick says increasingly patients are paying more out of pocket. This power means they can also get better and more timely service. Dermatologist Diane Baker says she and her colleagues aren't money grubbing. Only 10% of their income comes from cosmetic procedures, and all dermatologists keep appointments open for emergencies. She says people worried about possibly cancerous moles should absolutely insist they're seen urgently. In Boston, I'm Helen Palmer for Marketplace.
The good news is we're just shy of $160 billion in the red. As the government's fiscal year draws to a close, the latest projections put the deficit at less than $160 billion, and that'll be the smallest deficit since before the 9/11 attacks. Commentator David Frum says we need to keep it that way.
In 2001, we saw terrorists lay waste to New York's financial district, ground the U.S. civil aviation fleet, and impose huge and continuing security costs on governments, individuals, and firms. In response, the United States has fought two major wars and half a dozen small-scale counterinsurgency campaigns from Somalia to the Philippines. And through all this, and a wave of confidence-wrecking corporate scandals, too, the United States economy has posted just one single quarter of negative growth. Relative to national income, the federal budget deficit has now dipped to only a little worse than 1%, a fraction of the level that prevailed as recently as the 1980s. Credit for this improvement goes to the super strong U.S. economy. And since the economy is just a technical word for the hard work of people like you, well, congratulations. So my question to you is, how long can you keep at it? The credit markets look ugly. It's not just housing. Credit card defaults have jumped by one-third over the past quarter. Stock markets are shaking. And while economic growth is looking uncertain, government spending continues to rise rapidly, on health care above all. The Congressional Budget Office predicts that total government spending on Medicare and Medicaid will more than double as a share of national income over the next decade. We could pull out of Iraq tomorrow, quit Afghanistan, close down the entire Pentagon, and still barely make up for the projected rise in health care costs. We could abolish the Bush tax cuts. In fact, they'll soon expire anyway, and still face massive deficits by the 2020s because of that health care spending. You cannot balance the budget without restraining spending. But with the recent power shift in Washington, the most ferocious critics of Bush administration overspending are suddenly discovering an appetite for even greater spending of their own. That's bad math. It's bad economics. And if Americans want to stop it, they need to act to ensure that it becomes bad politics, too.
David Frum is resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. Got your own thoughts on how to keep the deficit down? Let us know. Just click on the contact link at marketplace.org. Coming up, bouncing back and building big along the Gulf Coast.
The value of what's here is getting out. And I think that the people will smell deals, and I think the money's going to come here.
But first, let's do the numbers. Bargain hunting pushed up stocks, especially in the tech sector. The Dow Jones Industrial Average bounced up 247 points, or 1.9%, to end at 13,289. The Nasdaq rose 62 points, or 2.5%, to finish at 2,563. The S&P 500 tacked on 31 points, 2.2%, for a final tally of 1,463. Apple snapped up 5.7% on the buzz around the expected launch of new iPod music players, just in time for Santa Claus. Nokia dialed up 7.25% on its launch of a new internet services brand that competes with Apple's iPod. Seagate Technology wrote up 3.8%. The hard drive maker raised its first quarter outlook. Intel marched up 4.7%. Overseas, markets were mixed. Bonds eased. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 4.56%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Want to know what's in the works at Marketplace? How about getting the latest news and features in an email? Sign up for the Marketplace Midday Update. It will keep you up to date on the day's business news and let you know what to expect on our next program. Go to marketplace.org and click on the newsletter link on the right.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases the second quarter gross domestic product report. The Center for Immigration Studies unveils a report projecting that immigration, both legal and illegal, will add about 100 million people to the U.S. population by 2060. And presidential hopeful Hillary Clinton chats up David Letterman on The Late Show. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Rizdal. Can you believe it's been 2 years to the day since Hurricane Katrina struck the Gulf Coast? In some ways, time flies by. In more painful ways, it drags on. The task of reconstruction has been delayed by difficult questions, such as the wisdom of building again in harm's way. Many businesses have moved to higher ground around New Orleans, leaving behind the former economic heart of the region. So where does that leave the low-lying areas? We sent Marketplace's Sam Eaton to one of Louisiana's most vulnerable spots to see how the recovery is going.
To find Plaquemines Parish on the map, just look for that narrow finger of Mississippi River Delta that juts out from Louisiana into the Gulf, barely rising above sea level. This was the first place Hurricane Katrina made landfall.
We were essentially ground zero for Katrina coming in.
Mike Mariana chairs the Plaquemines Parish Economic Development Board.
What you see is people trying every day, you know, scraping to bring this parish back.
And I broke down everything for y'all by cost.
Mariana and the rest of the board have gathered in a local church to discuss an advertising campaign that would promote the parish.
We're going to reach the most qualified people to come down here.
Parts of Plaquemines were completely wiped out by the storm. Mike Bush heads the Mississippi River Bank. He says the only thing left of one of his branches was the vault and the concrete slab it was bolted to.
I figured I was broke and the bank was gone, that all of our assets and all of our customers' assets were gone. Fortunately, that was not the case.
In the 2 years since the storm, Bush's community bank has grown 50%. Its profits have surged. He says this year alone, more than 30 new businesses have come into the parish.
It was an article Friday in the paper, and it was about, you know, how the devastated communities haven't come back as well as the rest. And you had Orleans and St. Bernard, and, you know, they didn't even mention Plaquemines.
Plaquemines has bounced back, though its geography is both a blessing and a curse. Devastating hurricanes are practically guaranteed, but the fact that it's the closest jumping-off point for oil and gas exploration in the Gulf means the cash keeps flowing in. Bush says the fishing's not so bad either.
The value of what's here is getting out. And I think that the people will smell deals, and I think the money's going to come here.
And for some, the money has already arrived. Arnie Cobbett just reopened his custom boat shop. He also owns a salvage business that's brought in millions of dollars removing damaged boats and debris. Not everyone's so lucky.
You know, one suffers, one profits.
Cobbett's profits now allow him to do what he likes best.
We build from scratch the 22-foot boats that are high dollar.
He says with most of the heavy recovery work now complete, he can gear up for the next phase of Plaquemines' economic revival, recreation.
Somebody's going fishing sooner or later. No matter how bad it is or how much it costs, people are still going to use their boats. And, you know, they're still going to buy them.
In northern Plaquemines, where Cobbett lives, land values and home construction surged after Katrina because of its higher elevation. In the lower parish, which was under 15 feet of water during the storm, few have returned. But those who stayed see a promising future.
I think we could be a mini Key West, but just a lot lower key.
Mike Butler owns the Venice Marina at the southern tip of Plaquemines Parish. He says Hurricane Katrina destroyed everything man-made here, but the fishing is better than ever.
Right after the storm in October, we were having 50 and 60 boats launch to go fishing because the fishing was so good that it kind of set the tone to say, well, as long as the fishery's here, they'll come. And that was kind of the premise that set forth, we're going to rebuild.
Butler dug into his personal savings to do that, and insurance costs are digging into his profits. But the risk is worth it, he says. He was born here, and he doesn't plan on leaving, even if that means losing everything all over again. In Plaquemines Parish, Louisiana, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
You'll find photos of Mike Butler and some of the other folks Sam spoke to on our website, marketplace.org. More than 1,000 people died when the levees broke and flooded 80% of New Orleans. Today, President Bush and his wife Laura went there to praise the people dedicating their lives to the city's renewal, the ones working feverishly to rebuild a place that has a reputation for being laid back. That's the whole idea behind the old song, Way Down Yonder in New Orleans, which the lyrics tell us is a land of dreamy dreams. These days, those dreams are for sale more than ever before, Melanie Peoples explains.
Maybe you're wondering what New Orleans is like these days. Say you haven't been here in the last 2 years. Or maybe you've never been here, and all you know about the Big Easy comes from the very uneasy images being replayed on TV this week. Or maybe you've seen one of the commercials with testimonials from tourists on Bourbon Street.
I expected that the hotels would be ready for us. I didn't know if the city would be ready for us. And my experience has been that quality service is even better.
Yes, the hotels and restaurants and tour companies are ready for you. The dream of daiquiri shops on every corner and a 24-hour supply of beignets lives on. This is the New Orleans you've always heard about, and it's one of the reasons people are still here. See, the French Quarter had hardly any flooding, so it's entirely possible to come here, eat, drink, and never see any destruction. You can do the same thing by following the river upstream into the Garden District. It's some of the highest land in New Orleans. It's also what they call the Isle of Denial. And if you can afford the real estate, you can pretty much manage to live your life without venturing into one of the neighborhoods that wasn't so lucky. That's one of two ways to stay sane in New Orleans these days, denial. The other is to have an unwavering faith that things will get better. If you're going to stay sane here, you wake up every day and take your pick.
We have come this far by faith.
City Council members like Cynthia Willard Lewis turn press conferences into pep talks.
The faith of the families in the community that despite all the odds, the devastation, the suffering and the losses, knew this was home. We have come this far by faith that the Holy Spirit has pulled together our men and women of moral conscience to say that New Orleans must be rebuilt. This international city must be restored.
City officials are buoyed by the efforts of the city's newest arrivals, a pep squad of 20-somethings, most of whom just graduated from college. They came down to do a bit of charity work and never went back. They called their friends back home and sold them on how they too could make a difference here, how they could change lives, rebuild New Orleans the way it deserves to be rebuilt. And I've got to hand it to these Johnny Appleseeds, sowing the city with their much-needed dreams. Hope is a commodity. The only question is, how long can the citizens of New Orleans afford to keep buying? Government statistics say $6 billion has been spent on cleanup and reconstruction, but most people have yet to see a check. And it's not just about money. Violent crime is up. We've had 19 murders in the last 2 weeks. One of our congressmen has been indicted for bribery. Another's been seeing prostitutes. And just this month, one of the city's most beloved councilmen pleaded guilty to taking bribes. As for the governor, she's not even running for re-election. It's easy to turn cynical or get depressed, to not like the person you find yourself becoming. Some people have given up, cashed in their dreams, and moved away. Others are on the verge. They are spent. New Orleans is a futures market these days, an economy built on hope, which unless we get some help real soon, may not spring eternal. In the land of dreamy dreams, I'm Melanie Peoples for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a diversified mix of international investments can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note.
Am I comfortable? I make a living.
That's what billionaire hotelier Leona Helmsley had to say for herself back in 1985. We mentioned last Wednesday that Helmsley passed away at the age of 87. Well, today we report that though the erstwhile Queen of Mean is no longer making any living at all, her dog will be quite comfortable in her absence. She left the pooch $12 million in her will. Helmsley was famously convicted for tax evasion in 1989. At the time, she pled innocence.
I have done nothing wrong. I'm innocent. My only crime is that I'm Leona Helmsley.
But her grandchildren may have a different take now that the will has been made public. Though her beloved hound will be sitting pretty, two of Helmsley's heirs are in the proverbial doghouse, having gotten nothing at all. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow leapt 247 points, 1.9%. The Nasdaq jumped 62 points, 2.5%. And the S&P 500 scooped up 31 points, 2.2%. Robbie Carman, Stephen Colon, Eric Johnson, Phil Richards, Joel Stein, and Tim Bomba are our engineers. Next time on the program, TV business news faces a new competitor.
They've seen they can increase their ratings, especially among younger viewers, by having more personality and having more emotion in their coverage. And I think they'll continue doing that.
I'm Bob Moon. Please join us again tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.